The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Let's get to this question of the consumer retail sales. A very important and interesting report out today, and we have just the person to discuss it with us. I'm referring to retail sales, first of all, and then Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesro Financial, good friend of the show, joining us on the Ring Central phone line. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And thanks for tweeting out the fact that you're on the show. We'll keep tweeting things out as we speak. How about the retail sales report? I was impressed by the upward revision as much as anything, because we know the first look at retail sales is a small part of the pool, right?
Exactly.
And that second reading is always a lot more accurate than the first reading, because instead of just getting 4,000 answers, they have, what, over 10,000 the second time.
Exactly. I mean, this is, you know, sort of the cruel joke on economists is the initial reports are really only very, very preliminary, and we get lots and lots of revisions, as you know, and we've had a lot of benchmark revisions to GDP growth as well. But, you know, the more you get, the more accurate the data gets, and the upward revisions to June was welcome news, and the core retail sales are still doing pretty well. That's very important as well. A little bit of concern about, you know, some of the furniture and appliances not doing as well as we'd like, given the housing market sort of volatility recently. I think they will come back, but that was where there was a little bit of a sort of cloud, a touch to the silver lining, or maybe a bit of sunshine through the clouds.
Well, Barclays always releases its tracking estimate after these types of numbers, and it said that it did send its Q3 GDP tracking up 0.2%. Is that somewhere in the range that it would for you as well, Diane?
Yeah, what we're looking at is, you know, somewhere close to 2.25% to 2.5% on upward revision now to the second quarter from 1.8. So the third quarter, we're looking a little north of 2%. Not a big reacceleration. It actually is a bit of a deceleration, but there's some inventory stuff going on. There's a lot of cross currents. That said, you know, the economy, we hope to be gaining some traction here. We do have some things going on in the housing market. The consumer is hanging on, which is great. And that's even in the face of higher gasoline prices, which is also very important.
At this point, we look specifically at the consumer, people going to department stores, electronics stores, and, you know, food stores, etc. Does tapering make any difference to them and the kind of spending they're doing? It's not roaring on the consumer side, but it seems to be this sort of modest pace of spending that's holding up in spite of sequester, in spite of wages not growing, in spite of so many things.
Well, you know, much of the strength in consumer spending also was we offset the payroll tax cut at the beginning of the year because of massive refinancing, mortgage refinancing, which has come off quite a bit. And that's one of the areas that we are a little concerned about. And the Fed doesn't like the Treasury bond at its current yield. They'd like to see it a little lower. That said, the reality is things like vehicle loans have actually gotten easier, and their rates have not moved at all in this environment. And so, you know, it's really, we do have some easing of consumer credit conditions even as the Fed engages in this. And that was the whole point, is the Fed could, you know, ease up on the gas as the private market, as the private sector begins to provide more credit. And I think that's a very important issue. There are real breaks, though, and this is something the Fed can't really deal with, and that is 35 and under households with the student debt that they have an overhang of. They're not buying houses for the first time. In fact, first-time home buyers were only 29% of the last number. That's well below the 34% earlier in the year, and well below anything we'd expect given affordability and the low rates out there. So the breakdown of households who can use that easier credit, it's really older households, and those are the households that don't need it as much.
Is there anything the Fed can do in terms of transmission to those places, those parts of the economy that you're saying are just not receiving any benefit from QE, Diane?
Well, that's the real conundrum, and, you know, it doesn't look like there is, which is why the debate about, and Kathleen's brought it up, the efficacy of the size of the balance sheet, you know, what does it really mean? Is it effective anymore? And what you're going to really see the Fed's focus on is the messaging component, the communications of, you know, we may be tapering, that's just easing up on the gas, it's not an end to easing, but it's just less aggressive easing. I think that's an important message. But the more important message for the Fed is they don't plan to pull the punch bowl, and they're still selling spiked drinks on the side for a long time to come. And that's important for markets. It may be good or bad. I do think an unintended consequence of this sort of tapering talk and the backup in yields that we saw from May to June, it's come off a little bit since then, actually revealed some potential bubbles that got a warning shot over the bow and may have gotten rid of some of the risks associated with the Fed's balance sheet.
Which bubbles are you talking about, Diane? Are you talking about the junk bond market or more?
Junk bond is one, but actually more broadly, I think it was in in a lot of credit markets. We were seeing a lot of REITs. We were seeing a lot of leverage come back into some markets that hadn't had leverage in the poor in terms of corporate and corporate buyouts. And so some of those places where leverage had actually reached pre-crisis highs, those are going to start to unwind a bit. And I think that's actually not bad news. I think a more moderate, you know, we want credit to recover, but we don't want bubbles. And so the Fed got this, I don't think they intended it, given the mea culpas that followed the June presser after the markets backed up even more by Chairman Bernanke. But I think the unintended consequence was actually somewhat positive in that some of the pressure on these bubbles, that if they had continued for the next 2 years, they would have been severe problems. Junk bond market is one, but many more credit markets, particularly in real estate. And I think that's very important.
And is that why Jim Bullard didn't dissent this time around, do you think?
Jim didn't, I don't think he didn't dissent this time because he got what he wanted.
Exactly.
The issue on inflation being a concern, and that is what he wanted in the statement, and the statement was incomplete as far as he was concerned. And, you know, remember, when one person dissents, it usually represents more than one person who either can't vote or somebody who doesn't also want to dissent. And he dissented because he did think low inflation was a problem and is a problem, and it is something you've seen into the talk more. And so the statement was incomplete in June, and when they did the most recent statement, they included that concern about low inflation, so we didn't need to dissent anymore.
First, Diane, I just want to come back to the issue of the Federal Reserve and the FOMC, particularly as we head towards Jackson Hole in the next 10 days or so. Jim Bullard took away his dissent the last time, and you said it's because he got what he wanted, the fact that they're looking at inflation and they're not as concerned about disinflation. Esther George, though, dissenting again because of the possibility of financial and economic imbalances being created by this. But you just said that they really sort of got rid of some of those. And I wondered why she's continuing to dissent.
Well, she's never been comfortable with the balance sheet and the expansion of the balance sheet. And remember, Esther comes from a regulatory environment. And where she is, her economies are doing much better. Her board is also very uncomfortable with using the alternative measures and the unconventional measures that the Fed has used. So, you know, she really is continuing. She picked up the baton from Tom Hennig, but comes from more of a regulatory framework and thinking in those terms. So she's going to be more conservative on that front. So I don't think that's much of a surprise. And it's right in nature with the Kansas City Fed. You know, she really did carry on the baton from Tom Hennig, but also has her own creds that are really very deep on the regulatory side of things and worrying about financial market imbalances. And that's not such a bad thing. We want that on the Fed. I think it's a good thing that, you know, the debate is healthy. You know, healthy debate is what we want. You know, dysfunctional debate is not what we want. That's what we have in Congress. But within the Fed, the functional debate is, you know, if we weren't questioning these unconventional measures, I'd really be worried because this is uncharted territory.
Yes.
And we should be questioning everything we're doing, right?
Yes. And Esther George, of course, like Tom Hennig before her, as you said, comes up on the bank regulation, bank examination side. Tom started at the Kansas City Fed as President Hennig, but prior to that had helped shut down a lot of banks in the early 80s. But Diane, so specifically, you say the tapering will start in September.
Yep.
Do you see a key amount? Do you see it continuing? Or do you see, well, we'll do some tapering and then we'll just sit and watch for a while and see what happens?
You know, that's my expectation, but that's where the uncertainty for the market is. And I think that's what the Fed didn't anticipate as they tried to talk about this. They opened up the whole, you know, spectrum of what is tapering? What is gradual tapering? Is it $20 billion a month for 3 months and then another $20 billion off? Is it $20 billion every month? Is it $10 billion every month? Is it $5 billion? Nobody knows. And that's why the September press conference, where they have a chance where Ben Bernanke can come out and explain things. Let's hope he. I think he's actually fairly clear. Sometimes it's too much information for markets. You know, they're sort of trying to go too far on managing market expectations. But that said, it does give a chance for the Fed to clarify what its position is on this. And there's one tool that we've not seen yet. Remember the seminal speech in 2002 that Ben Bernanke gave, his first speech as Fed governor in November 2002, provided the roadmap for where we are today in unconventional policies. And there's one aspect of that speech that is yet to be a tool that's unused, and that was actually putting a ceiling on actual bond rates. And that's something we've not seen yet, to put an explicit ceiling.
And how would they do that?
Well, they would shift the way they purchase things to say, we're going to buy whatever we need just to peg a certain bond yield.
Hmm.
And that's what he said he would do back in 2002,
Okay. And
it was his preferred method if all else didn't work. So it's the one thing, you know, no guarantees that that's out there, but it's interesting that it's the one piece of the toolkit of that you know, seminal, really, roadmap in 2002 that's not been tried yet. So the forward guidance on keeping bond yields down, on keeping rates down for a long period of time, it wouldn't be out of character to try to clarify communications by saying you're explicitly targeting a bond yield, would it?
Would the next Fed chairman, say it was Janet Yellen, do that?
Certainly, I think no matter who is picked, and I hate to feed the circus animals on this whole Fed chairman stuff, but I think no matter who you get, there's going to be some continuity. The lack of continuity would really be if we had a different president where we actually had the advisors of that president, and Mitt Romney, when he was running, his economic advisors wanted to take the Fed in an entirely different direction, and you know that's where the 180 would have been. Now, I think what's more important than just the Fed chairman transition, which is very important, is also we have a lot of governors coming up, and Sandy Pianalto is leaving at the Cleveland Fed, and she's a voting member next year as well in February. So you've got a lot of change, and that's going to add, you know, sort of insult to injury about uncertainty about monetary policy. So the Fed really needs to, as an institution, start mapping out the communication policy and be very explicit in September so that they set up an easier transition for whoever it is that takes over. Because there will be some level of
continuity. Interesting because Larry Meyer, former Fed governor, told us on a show recently, Diane, that the biggest gift the Fed chairman, Bernanke, can give the next Fed chair, whoever it is to start the tapering process now. I think echoing what you're saying. I want to look at the global economy with you, Diane, because you went on a very interesting trip. Speaking of circus animals, I'm thinking, you know, wild animals in Africa. And kind of a nice jumping off report you did looking at the various regions of the world, the economy. This is so important to a lot of investors now. Tell us about your recent trip and how it made you then think about the global economy.
Well, you know, one of the most important things is a couple of issues that came up is that, you know, the developing world is not doing as well, with the exception of sort of Mexico. And we brought up the idea, you know, the issue, the front page of the newspapers these days, that Mexico is going to liberalize their oil industry. If they actually move forward on that, and I think they are, I think the handicapping on this is very good. That is a game changer, not just for Mexico, but we're North American free trade with them. And we are seeing onshoring. That's a huge going to be reduction in oil prices down the road and control of energy on North American side. So I think that's huge for the U.S. and for Mexico, and it's a major move forward for Mexico. Outside of Mexico, many of the developing economies, China, Brazil, Turkey, the ones that were our number one stars, are now our number one concerns in the global economy. And, you know, being in the continent of Africa itself, it's amazing to sort of see six of the top performing economies in the world, fastest growing, are of the top 10 are in the continent of Africa, and seven of the top 10 most corrupt are also in the continent of Africa. So it really is a conundrum to be there, but being out in the middle of safari in the jungle is a nice metaphor for survival of the fittest and natural selection, and what they're trying to do in terms of preserve these animals that may be dead, lions, leopards, rhinos, elephants, Cape buffalo, within 20 years, they may be gone and extinct. And what they try to do to intervene, they only intervene on human error, which to me is a metaphor for how governments should keep markets efficient. Unfortunately, we have a lot of human error. That doesn't mean a lot of intervention, but it's human error they intervene to help. You know, a buffalo that had a broken leg, they said, hey, he broke it in nature. And nature deals with it.
Wow, yeah. Well, Diane, you say in particular nature would deal with Texas if Mexico were to liberalize its oil industry, and this is in Parliament. There are two different proposals in Parliament, so we have to see what actually ends up happening. But it wouldn't benefit Arizona so much. Texas doesn't really need it, though, does it?
Texas will take what it can get, believe me. And, you know, they are the second largest state in the country, and, you know, they like boasting how strong their economy is, and it will be stronger. Arizona, you know, the interesting issue there is that the immigration laws in Arizona have, Mexico has chosen to shift a lot of their trade flows through Texas, and it's been a fairly major shift out of Arizona because of the, you know, sort of anti-immigration laws and the specifically Mexico target laws. They see it as in Mexico in Arizona, and it's cost Arizona quite a bit in terms of trade flows. And now you're talking about a part of the world that's actually doing better, that could be doing a lot better very soon, and already the energy infrastructure in Texas as well. And Texas is thrilled. I was just down in Texas, and they are very excited. And it doesn't matter. I was actually in Austin, which is kind of an interesting part of Texas, and they're very, very thrilled about what could be coming out of Mexico, and they've been watching it very closely.
And for Mexicans as well, this is huge. The oil industry is a gigantic part of their modern history. It's an industry that has potentially so much wealth for them. At the same time, the infrastructure needs updating. They really need, I mean, but I think it's a very exciting change. When you look at some of the other regions of the world, I want to particularly ask you about Africa, because we have been kind of on a semi-regular basis talking to people about the big change in Africa, potentially. It's not so much about aid now. It's about investment, about where the money is going. You traveled there. You're studying as an economist. What is your view? Can we believe it this time? Is it really a change?
I think there is a real change, although, you know, it's really hard because South Africa, which, you know, with revisions to GDP, because they're not very good at counting it over there, Nigeria may exceed South Africa in size soon. And Nigeria, for all of its faults, is actually doing some interesting things. They actually have a film industry, and they set up the first set up by a woman, nonetheless, the first African Academy Awards. So it's not just oil in Nigeria, which is interesting to me. Zimbabwe, a mess. But there are some places in Africa that really are attempting to make change. What will be interesting to see is, you know, the Chinese had been major investors in Africa, and they're not going to be able to invest as much, but they also didn't really contribute to stopping corruption. Let's just put it that way, in the nice way. In some ways, they contributed to corruption, and now you're seeing an influx of investment. South Africa is now the largest exporter to the rest of Africa, which is an interesting thing. It is easier to do business in South Africa. They've got a lot of corruption in their own government, and it's going to be a while till they get through that, I think at least 20 years. But I see a lot of potential there. It really is amazing. The thing that we're missing is infrastructure, and they do need a lot of investment. But they are getting investment now, and they're getting it from within Africa. They're also getting it from abroad. The U.S. is a minor investor, not as major investor, but it will really be interesting to see how we see some of the investment shifting. France used to be the largest investor in Africa, and it no longer is.
What's deciding that, Diane? Because we've had several people on who sort of make it their job to try and get the U.S. to invest more in Africa, because whoever puts the infrastructure in is definitely going to have the sort of first mover advantage, right?
Right.
And it's not us, and it's several countries that are getting there first. Who are they, and why not the U.S.?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's still a reluctance to go into what they see as, one, they worry about it, you know, already has Africa been tapped out. I hear a lot of people saying, well, Africa's had a major run-up. I'm like, yeah, but Africa doesn't even, I mean, what they consider highways there, there's a highway in Cape Town that's not finished, and, you know, if you drive off it, you fall off a cliff, basically, because it's in the air. So, you know, infrastructure is a relative concept, and the only country that has it is really South Africa, so it has infrastructure. So the need for infrastructure is huge in Africa. Still. And the only places they've gotten it is sort of the commodity stuff that China's come in and done. And
so potentially, you know, that's a great, if you look for ways to hop on this frontier part of the investment world,
absolutely.
Infrastructure, companies investing in infrastructure in Africa?
Yes. Infrastructure, power grid, hugely important. The power grid in South Africa, most power grids with any kind of range of you know, in margin, it's 15% capacity they have left over so that they don't, in case they have, you know, some kind of shock. When we were in South Africa, we were running less than 1% cushion on the power grid, and it doesn't go to all of South Africa. So this is a big move forward, and I think there is still a lot of opportunity there.
Dan Swong, thanks for this walk around the world with us. Appreciate it. Dan Swonk, chief economist at Mesro Financial, sees the Fed tapering in September.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius and XM satellite radio channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.